Hey everyone, it's Christian. Before we begin today's episode, I'd like to acknowledge that the land on which we record this podcast from is on the unceded Algonquin Anishinaabe territory. The peoples of the Algonquin Anishinaabe Nation have lived on this territory for millennia. The Circle on Philanthropy and Aboriginal Peoples in Canada says this well. Indigenous communities have a long history of practices and principles on how to ethically steward resources. The philanthropic sector in Canada is relearning a way of knowing that is in alignment with Indigenous ways of knowing, being, and stewarding resources, and our team at Beyond the Bake Sale is committed to that relearning process and the elevating of voices that teach and educate those in the sector on that ethical stewarding of resources. If you're looking for resources on your journey to truth and reconciliation as a nonprofit or charitable organization, I highly recommend that you visit the Circle's website at www.the-circle.ca. That's www.the-circle.ca. Now, on with today's episode. This is Christian Robillard, and you're listening to Beyond the Bake Sale, where we help you raise more time, talent, and treasure for the causes you care about. On this episode, I sat down with Jasmine Shaw, an amazing leader in the STEM space and the co-founder of the Ontario Sick Day Relief Project. Jasmine is an engineer, entrepreneur, speaker, and advocate for positive change in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. She has over 5 years of experience in system design and project management in the aerospace sector, leading both engineering and enterprise-level activities. In 2021, she started a service-based business that helps women in STEM achieve their full career potential through mentorship, networking, and storytelling. That same year, she also co-created the Ontario Sick Day Relief Project, an emergency fund to support Ontario's essential workers through the third wave of COVID-19. The project raised $66,000 in paid sick days for over 130 people. This episode is for you if you're looking at how to raise money for a quote-unquote unsexy cause, if you have a tiny budget, and if you want to hear a masterclass in capitalizing on a moment in time to galvanize support for your cause. I hope you love listening to this episode as much as I loved recording it. Jasmine, welcome to the show. It's so wonderful to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Christian. I'm excited to be here.
I am so excited for you to be here. I know that when you first started this project we're going to talk about today, the Ontario Sick Day Relief Project, one, I was sad that it had to be a thing in the first place, but two, I was so excited to see a group of people step up to take on what shouldn't have had to be a cause, but really represented what concerned citizens can do when they put their time and talents to making social good happen. But before I get into that, what I would love to talk to you about and hear from you is a bit of your superhero, superheroine origin story. Like, if you could think about the beginnings of your life career as that comic book sequence or as the intro reel to a movie in like 5 to 7 panels or scenes, what would those look like?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So first and foremost, I am an engineer. I am a fellow Carleton University grad like yourself. And I am most recently an entrepreneur that started my own online business, providing career development services to women in STEM. I am a, I'd say, lifelong advocate for women in STEM, helping them achieve their career goals. So I'm really excited to have turned that into a business now. And most recently, I am really a member of the community that helps provide sick days to folks in need. So that origin story, I think, is really interesting because I, again, come from a technical background, being an engineer. But as a concerned citizen, I saw this gap in our society, and I was listening to a press release one day, and everyone was really expecting an announcement on paid sick days, and it didn't happen. And I woke up the next day and thought, what can I do to help? And I thought about starting a GoFundMe to really just step in and provide that immediate relief to folks. So it was very authentic, very quick how it happened. But that's the origin story for the Ontario Sick Day Relief Project.
I love that. One, I've always loved that you are an engineer because I think that the sector needs more engineers involved in it in terms of the analytical thinking power, the problem solving, and not just looking to fix things, but always looking at how things can be tweaked and made to be better. And I think that's a mentality that more people in our sector need to have, but also just the quickness and the nimbleness to respond to such an urgent need. I was wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit about some of that early days in terms of some of the first steps that you looked at taking when you were forming this project, and maybe also talking about bringing in other people and kind of things along those lines.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I also agree that we need more engineers in the public sector and nonprofit sector. So the early days of the Ontario Sick Day Relief Project, I would say early hours, actually, early 24 hours, really looked like myself just thinking and contemplating a way that I could help people. I knew that we need to get access to funds really quickly, that because that's what all the experts on Twitter and social media were saying, is that we need to give funding to people quickly. This isn't something that can take a long time. Like, there is a sense of urgency to it. So I turned to a platform that I was familiar with, that I knew other folks had used, which was GoFundMe. And I set up the account, or rather the campaign, you know, 12 hours after I saw this press release. And then within another few hours, I was actually contacted by one of my future team members, Lindsay, who was a nurse in Toronto. And she was thinking about doing something similar, but just hadn't pressed, you know, the go button. So she reached out to me and she brought in her friend and colleague, Connie, who's also a nurse. And then we banded up and we really put this together. Within about 24 hours from there, we had our website up. We had applications up for folks to actually apply to receive the funding. And we were running a pretty intensive social media campaign, primarily on Twitter, to really get the word out about the project. But it all came together in about 48 hours. And definitely, I realized very quickly with how much speed this project was picking up that it was a smart decision for me to bring other people on, because I would not have been able to handle just the burden of this project by myself.
Absolutely. And I think, again, the speed that you demonstrated is a lesson for others in the sector to be able to see, or even people who are interested in doing something in the social good space of wanting to respond to a community that they're seeing that's demonstrated and has a lot of evidence to back it up. Before we jump into some of those first steps that you took and maybe some of the basics, could you explain for our listeners what the project all entailed and maybe some of the features or some of the characteristics that you think are important for our listeners to know?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So the Ontario Sick Day Relief was an emergency fund to provide paid sick days to essential workers. So the project lasted about 2 months. And throughout that duration, we raised over $65,000 in paid sick days that was all distributed to essential workers. So I think an important characteristic of the project is that it was indeed a project. It was not a program. It was not a government-funded initiative that was meant to be long-lasting. It was really a stopgap. So we acknowledged very quickly that this was not a long-term solution, that we needed the government to step in to really solve this problem, but it was simply a way to, you know, get funds to folks who otherwise had to choose between going into work sick or, you know, to put food on the table. So I think that's one of the most important characteristics, was that we needed to get it out there quickly. And that's why we ended it in June, once we had distributed all the funding and the third wave was kind of coming down, because we knew that it was time for us to simply wrap things up.
I'm curious, just from my own personal side of things, I love that it had a time constraint on it, because I think that a lot of groups try to make themselves stick around for longer than they need. And I like the way you described it, of it being a project as opposed to an ongoing program. Were there ever any conversations about continuing on with something, knowing that you had this great team of individuals with a proven track record of doing important social and community work? Were there any conversations about what it could transform into, or wanting to do something else after the fact?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So we actually talked about that very early on when our team formed, and we actually decided from the beginning that it would be a short-term initiative, simply because we all had kind of other social activities that we were participating in. So for me, it's Women in STEM. For Lindsay and Connie, they are very much involved in the health sector, but in different areas. And we knew that we wouldn't be able to sustain this long term. But we also were cognizant to not simply you know, start this initiative, gain a lot of traction, and then kind of leave folks hanging. So we did, I think we did a pretty good job of tying up the loose ends and making sure that we transitioned our applicants to other resources, other programs that they could turn to if they still needed additional funding or support after our project ended.
Of course. And I think those two pieces that you've highlighted of understanding people's commitment right from the get-go, saying this is what we're willing to do and this is what we feel comfortable doing given the situation, but also knowing when it's time to just pass on something, even if there might be pressure to do it, I think are two important fundamentals that any project can learn from. I'm curious, Jasmine, I think our listeners would take a ton of value in learning how you and your team were able to raise $65,000 in the span of not a lot of time and really around something that might not necessarily be the sexiest of cause, but I think it's indisputable that it's such an important one. Could you walk us through some of the fundamentals that were there, some of the basics that were there that you think helped you to be able to raise that money and then also to be able to get it out the door to the people that needed it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I mentioned that we use GoFundMe for collecting the funds. And for us, this was one of the key components of our project that enabled us to scale because it's a well-known platform. A lot of folks have used it before. So there was some kind of credibility there as opposed to us just saying, hey, e-transfer me, you know, $500. So that was one component. And the other component that I don't want to call it luck because that's not very transferable to other people, but I think it was the timing. So a lot of folks, if you recall Twitter in March, a lot of people were talking about paid sick days. It was very important at the time, it still is, but it was getting a lot of social media coverage at the time because of the lack of paid sick days and how it was contributing to the third wave. So I think we really just saw an opportunity and jumped on it, and we leveraged the conversations that were happening on Twitter to promote it. So Twitter was actually our primary means of promotion. We did dabble in Instagram for a bit, but honestly, at that point in time, again, March, April, May, around the third wave, Twitter was kind of the place to be for all things COVID-19. That's where a lot of the top doctors, physicians, nurses, teachers, and social justice experts, they were using Twitter. There's a lot of hashtags that we tapped into. It was getting retweeted a lot. So I think that was a key component that enabled us to scale so quickly. And of course, leveraging our respective networks, you know, be that our family and friends and then their family and friends, and really just kind of using those connections and all of the fan out. And then I think the last thing that enabled us to raise that much funding, again, having to do the timing, was that we knew that people wanted to help because it wasn't just the doctors and physicians and other experts calling for paid sick days. Regular folks like myself, they wanted to step in and do something. And this gave them an avenue or a medium to contribute to help another person out. So I think that was another component that enabled us to raise that much funding.
Absolutely. And I love that you're almost talking about a lot of the fundamentals that we have in the sector around reaching out to the three Fs, to the friends, the family, and the fans of whatever is that you're doing, the piggybacking off of existing hashtags, and also just the tapping in of people's understanding of why this is a particular issue. I'm curious, from the fundraising perspective and the messaging perspective, Jasmine, were there certain messages or certain styles of message that you deliver to people that you found had a bigger reaction as opposed to some others? Like if you used more of a certain type of language versus you used maybe a more technical part of language or anything like that, that you noticed in between the messages?
That's a really good question. And I wish I had looked into some of our Twitter statistics before the podcast that I could tell you. So Lindsay and Connie were the Twitter pros and they were kind of in charge of all of our messaging. And I'm sure that they know what the subtleties are. So I don't know that I can provide a lot of granularity in terms of the type of messaging, at least from what I posted like personally on my own platforms about the initiative. What really resonated with folks was just that opportunity to help someone out, was really sharing that this was the way that you, as kind of an ordinary citizen that maybe hadn't been affected so much by COVID-19, but you knew it was affecting other people, that you could step in and you could still do something, and that the money was going directly to an essential worker that maybe like everyone has interacted with essential workers throughout the pandemic. So I think it was just building the connection between the recipients of the funding and the donors that at least I noticed was pretty powerful.
Of course. In the fundraising world, I find it's the situation when you write for encouraging people to be philanthropic, you want them to answer the question themselves, is this me? So when reading this, could I see myself in this particular situation or somebody that I know in a situation? And often that motivates me to be philanthropic and to be generous with my time, talent, or treasure. And it sounds like that's exactly something that you and your team were able to tap into.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And you talked a little bit about being able to leverage the hashtags that were existing. Were you able to benefit from other, let's say, influencers, air quotes, in terms of medical professionals or in terms of others in the space to be able to amplify your message and then be able to take advantage of that boost, I suppose, as compared to just keeping sending out your messaging in your kind of lanes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Great question. So because Lindsay and Connie are very well connected into the health community in Toronto, we were eventually able to tap into a couple of, I believe, doctors that had pretty wide followings on Twitter that retweeted some of our tweets that definitely helped get the message out. But I find that there's actually one initiative that's not our project, but a very similar one, a community fund that really leveraged the influencer approach. And I think they did such an amazing job with it that it'd be really valuable to share. So it's called CoCare, and it's a community funded micro grant initiative. And they start at the same time as us. And we're also trying to support folks during COVID-19 and the third wave. And they actually partnered with really well-established creators and influencers on Instagram specifically to host a giveaway, which of course we've all seen giveaways, like it's something we're really used to seeing on Instagram. So basically how it worked is that you donated to their initiative on GoFundMe, and then you were entered to win either a product or service from that particular influencer. And I thought this was such a great approach because, again, so many people, they're used to entering giveaways on Instagram, but again, they also want to help people out. They want to donate to causes they care about. And of course, it helped CoCare get the message out about their initiative to a much wider audience than if they were just to stay in their own lane. So I think with that particular giveaway strategy, I looked at their numbers. So they got 322 entries and over $5,000 just from partnering with these micro influencers. If anyone wants to check out the specific logistics of how CoCare ran that, their Instagram is CoCare Initiative, and they have all of the posts and kind of logistics about that giveaway.
Yeah, that's so smart, especially when you're able to leverage individuals who want to have their audience be engaged in something beneficial. And we know that people care about other people and they care about causes. So it seems like a perfect marriage, but also like not necessarily with the same model, but that influencer model of amplifying messages is one that is fairly straightforward to enact, especially when it just means a retweet or giving people some messages to share or doing things in a format that people are familiar with on certain platforms.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Something that I also found particularly interesting, Jasmine, that you and the team, I think, did a really good job with is the transparency of the funding. And in the looking back on the website when it was going up, I think that you did a great job of sharing when money came in, but also when it went out, which I think is something that some groups, even in the professional space, don't always do a great job at. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your and the team's approach in terms of the transparency and the accountability when it came to that funding coming in and that funding going out the door.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So this was something that we realized very early on. We had to be extremely detail-oriented about. So just as some background, the way that GoFundMe works is they release funding every day, of course, if there's still funds in the account, to a bank account. And what we realized was that there are e-transfer limits. So we couldn't necessarily just keep pumping out the money to applicants because of our own banking limitations. So we wanted to be really transparent, not only with the donors, but especially with the applicants who were the ones that were really relying on the funding, to let them know when they could expect to receive it. So we spent a lot of time looking at our e-transfer limits, talking to our banks to see if we could raise some of those limits temporarily and do the calculations to see when we would max out, just so that people were informed and could plan around when to receive the money. And I think that's important because, again, it just, you know, shows that we are working to like resolve the problem, but also so that people can plan around it, you know, so that they can kind of budget accordingly as to when they can expect to receive the money. And on the donor side, it shows that we're not simply taking the money and disappearing, that we are distributing it actively. That was something that I personally really wanted to make sure we did a good job of. And I'm glad you noticed, because I think we did try to do that. But yeah, I guess a word of caution to anyone using GoFundMe is make sure that you know, or that you're very intentional about which bank account the money is going to, and that you have the appropriate e-transfer limits in place.
Absolutely. And I have a follow-up for that in just a moment, but curious if along this project, you or the team received any criticism around this particular approach for any component of it. And if you did, are there some suggestions you have of how you went about dealing with that criticism or that critiquing or that feedback that maybe wasn't the most positive?
Mm-hmm. For sure. So early in the project, when we were still getting traction, we did want to collaborate with existing organizations that were in the space, that were well established, and that really knew the space better than we did. Because again, we came in pretty cold, not knowing much about this space. So, and we acknowledged that. But of course, a lot of folks did see this project as almost excusing the government from doing their job of implementing a long-term funded, policy-backed paid sick day program, where unfortunately, like, we didn't see the same way, because folks still needed that money quickly. And while we absolutely agree that there must be legislated paid sick days, people still needed to pay their bills, pay their rent, you know, feed their families. So we really saw it as a yes and. So yes, we do need legislated paid sick days, and people need money right now. So they're not mutually exclusive. But that was something that once we received that critique from a few folks, I think we tried to respond to it with compassion, because these are folks who have been really advocating in this space for a long time for more systemic change, which is, that's the hard work. The project is almost the easy work, because, you know, we put up the GoFundMe and we received a lot of publicity. So we didn't put in grueling years and years and years of effort to really move the needle in this space. So I can totally understand why someone would perceive this project as stepping on their toes. So the first thing was just to kind of, you know, receive it with compassion and empathy. And then we were just really careful and intentional about our messaging moving forward, and reiterating that it is a time-bound project, that we're not trying to fix a systemic issue. We acknowledge there's a systemic issue, but that we're just trying to help out how we can.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important caveat, is to say that it's time-bound and it's not something where we're trying to remove any of the obligation of government entities or the government itself to work in this space. But sometimes it's required that there's an intervention of private resources in order to support those who have fallen through the cracks or who might not qualify under existing infrastructure that does exist. And as you said, it's time bound, so it isn't going forever. I think that's an appropriate caveat, especially when you're doing some type of work in the social impact world, and that you're also working with the appropriate parties in the sector to be able to educate yourself and learn and be responsible with the resources that you do have, especially with when it's the case you don't have as many as some other established organizations. Not that $65,000 is a small amount of money, but in the grand scheme of things, of people who probably needed that money, it's modest to address the short-term concerns.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think that I doubt the government even saw our project. It probably didn't even, you know, it's not even a drop in the pond for them. And there's a lot of causes that end up being philanthropic that probably should be funded by a more sustainable government program that aren't. So, you know, of course we wish that they were funded, but we still try to help out in ways that we can.
Mm-hmm. And that's a whole rabbit hole that we will not get to today. But on the topic of other causes, I'm always curious, when you were starting this project with your co-collaborators, was there a point where you thought about, let's say, partnering with an existing organization, or looking and seeing, oh, these organizations closely reflect the vision and values that we would want to be aligned with? Or was that something that didn't come up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So once we really got the ball rolling and we're starting to promote the project on Twitter, we did receive a lot of offers from the community, whether that was because they were running their own project or simply because they wanted to volunteer their time. In the end, we didn't end up kind of integrating with an existing organization. At the time, we really just felt that, like, you know, we had enough momentum and drive to kind of do this thing on our own, but we were very intentional about collaborating, about amplifying other organizations as well. And I think that's something that we did that other folks can maybe benefit from, is that even though, you know, there may be other groups in your space that are doing similar things, ultimately, these are community-based initiatives. And I think it's important to focus on collaboration over competition, since collaboration will always drive us forward more quickly than competition. So we were really intentional about amplifying funds that were specifically for BIPOC essential workers, or for LGBTQ2+ essential workers, or immigrants that, you know, our cause didn't focus on specifically, but other projects were focused on. And I think that was really great, because we had a lot of social, I guess, capital at the time, with a lot of folks seeing our project. We were then able to amplify other projects that maybe didn't have as much visibility.
And I can imagine too, there might be some people who would like to contribute to that as a cause, but might not be as comfortable donating, let's say, through this particular project for whatever personal reasons they might have, but they might want to direct it towards something that is more specific or more niche in terms of filling a certain need, and being able to elevate those. And as you said, be more cooperative and collaborative as opposed to competitive. Because I think that when you start to get into that competitive space, you start to create winners and losers. And that's not what the sector or service work should be about at all. It should be about everyone is able to win as a result of working together.
Yes, absolutely. And that wasn't even something that crossed our mind. Like, we were never concerned about, oh, this group will get funding and we won't get funding, because ultimately the money was still going to essential workers who needed it in order to either to get tested for COVID or to stay home because they had COVID. So ultimately it was contributing to the same end cause. So we had no qualms whatsoever about amplifying those groups.
So we've talked a bit about some of these fundamentals around leveraging your three Fs, or your friends, family, fans, about being able to tap into existing messaging or existing hashtags or existing trends that are at a certain point in time, kind of combining that opportunity plus timing to create that luck, if you would, talking about the way, making sure that people understand how they can contribute and seeing themselves in it, the importance of the transparency, elevating other voices in addition to our own, tapping into influencers. Are there any other pieces you think that contributed towards your success and the project's success that we haven't talked about so far?
I think we've mostly covered everything. The influencer piece, that was actually one of the more innovative aspects that I did want to highlight for folks who maybe haven't considered that and have only gone through their own kind of personal channels to promote their project or their cause. Because I think that is, again, it's something a lot of folks are familiar with, and it can just be a great way to, you know, further kind of distribute your work. I think we've mostly covered everything in terms of the factors that contributed to our success. Just something to be aware of, especially if you are running a project that does end up picking up a lot of steam, is that you will most likely be contacted by the media. And for us, we had never done media interviews before, like radio or live television or press. So that was something that was very new to us. And while media is great, you know, there's always they're trying to get something out of it. They're trying to publish a story or to make a headline. So the advice that I would provide to folks maybe do find themselves in this situation is to have your media points and your key messages available and really stick to that. So know, you know, the purpose of your project, who it's impacting, why you're doing it, and really stay within those bounds. So for example, we were contacted by a ton of radio shows and TV shows asking for us to talk about the project. And a lot of folks also asked us to talk about the political climate and why is the government not stepping up? Why does your project exist? Why do we not have legislated paid sick days? And while that's an interesting story, again, we aren't the experts in this space. And again, we're intentional with our message and knew that this project does not absolve the government, but we're not political scientists. We were not here to shame or to blame anyone in particular. So we had to politely decline those specific interviews because we didn't want to kind of bring that association to our project, because that was never the intent of our project. So that would be my advice to folks, is just know your key messages and stick to them very strictly.
And were you able to tap into any help or support to help you come up with those key messages? Or was it something from the get-go that you were fairly comfortable or confident on in terms of knowing what those key points were going to be? Or is it something that you, over multiple interviews, let's say, came to be more comfortable with knowing and refining? Or what did that process look like?
So Lindsay and Connie work at a hospital in Toronto, and we were actually able to leverage their media team to kind of give us like media 101. So they taught us about the key messages. They reviewed all of our speaking notes, which was a fantastic resource. And we also wanted to make sure that, you know, we were running this as individuals. We didn't want the project to be associated with our employers. So I would say, even if you're running a project that has nothing to do with your employer, they may even have, like, the marketing and communications team may have some resources for you, and they may be willing to review your speaking points to provide some guidance or tips. And of course, ensure that there is no association with the company.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an important thing to remember too, in that when you start any type of project, look to your network to see who's able to help with certain components of things, and don't feel like you have to take on everything alone, because people want to be generous with their time, but they require an ask. And it sounds like you're able to articulate that ask very well and leverage the resources that were at your disposal, which I think is so smart, instead of having to try to reinvent the wheel or try to build an expertise that you don't necessarily have time or even potentially interest in building, or it's just better for another group to take on a piece of that because that's their natural aptitude and their profession.
Definitely not reinventing the wheel and leveraging folks with particular expertise and skills. That is actually one other thing that we did, now that I think about it, is I mentioned that a lot of folks reached out to us to volunteer and to help out with the project. And we received messages from so many incredible folks who were experts in marketing and digital marketing. We had one volunteer who was a data scientist and created all of our beautiful graphics to really highlight the impact of our work, which is so critical to, again, the transparency of the project. So that was fantastic. We didn't do that ourselves. Like, they were, you know, the expert with that. We also leveraged folks who had experience in videography and just different kind of niches, so that we didn't have to do all of it ourselves, and we could also, you know, bring other people into the fold.
So on that note, Jasmine, I'm curious about that balance and that teamwork side of things. So maybe this is two questions, but on the teamwork side of things, when you have so many different people, especially distributed over geographic regions and who haven't necessarily met each other before, but that are all motivated by this cause, what does that teamwork dynamic look like? And what are your recommendations for when you have a project, but you want to make sure that while you want to advance it, you also don't want one particular person to completely take it over, or making sure you're picking the right people to be on your team? Because we know that a bad team member can really sink a project or make it miserable to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And it is really important to the success of the project. And I think that's why our project was successful, because we actually had a really great leadership team. So I would say that identifying the core members of your team, whether it's, you know, your leadership team, your founders, whatever you want to call it, but like those 2 to 4 people who are making the kind of executive decisions about the project, that's what enabled us to move quickly, was that it was just the 3 of us. Even though I hadn't met them before, again, we kind of got lucky and we jived really well. And in the early days of the project, we did meet, I believe, every day because of how quickly things were ramping up. And that allowed us to, I mean, at least for me, because I didn't know them, they knew each other, for me to get to know them very quickly, for them to get to know me very quickly. And we all kind of have a project management background, so we were very clear with assigning tasks and actions to each person. We were also really just respectful of each other's capacity. If someone had a busy day, we would redistribute the tasks. And we were also intentional about when to bring people on. So I believe in the first week or maybe 2 weeks, we didn't actually bring on any additional team members or volunteers. We were running the show ourselves. It doesn't make sense to bring on other people. And I think the important piece of advice for your listeners is to know why you want to bring someone on and what exactly is the task that they will be performing. So are you just growing your team, or do you actually have a specific task and goal that you want to accomplish, just be really clear with why you want to bring people on. So I think that's what enabled us to be successful, was just being respectful of each other's capacity, being intentional with growing the team, and knowing why we are bringing people on board.
Something I'm particularly curious about, Jasmine, is this project obviously wasn't a full-time job for any of you, if anyone on the team. And I think that it can be really easy for a project to be all-consuming and start to creep into your work life, start to creep into your personal life, whether in terms of time or even in terms of mental space. What are your suggestions, or what were suggestions that others on your team had in order to create those proper boundaries and make sure that you didn't just keep putting time in and then leading to that either burnout or that creep into other aspects of your life? What did all of that look like?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because it can be so difficult to navigate those boundaries, especially, I don't know about how Lindsay and Connie felt about this, but for me, I felt an obligation to this project because I had been largely unaffected by COVID-19. I was working remotely from home. I didn't know anyone that had gotten sick. I still had my job. I had so many things to be grateful for that I felt really just, again, obligation to help these people and to put in the hours to make sure that they got their money as soon as possible. So it was really difficult for me to really kind of call out myself and say, okay, it's like 1 a.m., you need to go to bed, you know, you can work on it tomorrow. But I think what we did that really helped us was, again, just identifying our capacity. And this is a skill that I've learned in so many areas, or rather that I've used so in so many areas of my life, both at my job and my business and my personal life, is knowing how much time in a day I can actually put towards something and then blocking out time to work on it. I think that's so important, so that first of all, you don't overcommit to your team members. So they know how much time you have to put towards the project. And you also respect your own boundaries by saying, okay, I have 2 hours to work on this. And then after that, anything that doesn't get done, I'll work on it tomorrow. So that would be one thing, is just being clear with yourself and your team members about your capacity. The other thing in terms of the boundaries, for a project at least, is being clear with the recipients. So letting them know, for example, some of the issues about the e-transfers, that was really stressful for me because I felt so bad that we couldn't get the money to them. But the best you can do is just be honest and let them know that, you know, we are working to resolve the issue, that there was going to be a delay, and that there wasn't much we can do about it at that time. And, you know, most people were really understanding and still grateful for the funding. So that's the second thing. And the last thing would be, preferably before you start a project like this, talk with your, if you have a partner or, you know, someone in your life that maybe a roommate or something that is impacted by the project, talk with them, just so they're aware of the commitments and if, you know, they may get pulled into it. With my fiance, I ended up pulling him into the project to help out with the e-transfers once I hit my limit on my bank account. But he had no idea when I started the project. I just told him, hey, guess what? I started this project. But of course, I should have had that conversation before so that, you know, he was aware of what I was signing up to and how it would affect our relationship and also how it would affect him. So those are my three tips for setting and respecting boundaries.
I love those. I think those are ones that not only those doing projects off the side of their desk can benefit from, but also those who have been in the sector for decades, in terms of being clear on what roles that you're trying to fill and that you've agreed to, and not letting those creep up and up and up in the perpetual feeling of having to escalate, making sure that you set those good time constraints, knowing your limits, having those boundaries and conversations with friends and family, but also just that good overall communications and making sure people know what's happening and when. And also, I think a piece of it too, from what it sounds like, Jasmine, is making sure you don't try to make the project into something it doesn't need to be. Like staying in a particular lane and making sure that people on your team are comfortable with, okay, we could be all of these things to all these people, or we can accept that this is going to be our philanthropy, this is going to be our service towards others, and we're okay with that. Because if we keep escalating, we're going to burn ourselves out and we're going to become bigger or more intense than we necessarily need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't boil the ocean. And I think that's something, whether it's in philanthropy or I am experiencing this now as an entrepreneur, there's in companies, I know in my company, we face this. There's so many things you could do. There's always so many problems to solve or solutions that you could implement. But ultimately, if you try to focus on too many things, then you get nothing done. And for us, with the project, it was just important to get this one thing done well so that we could help a small group of people. And we did that. And that's because we were really clear about our objective, about how we were going to accomplish it. And we didn't try to boil the ocean.
Absolutely. Wondering, Jasmine, were there one or two roadblocks or particularly big challenges in establishing and running this project that you might share with our listeners, and also how you overcame or didn't overcome one or two of those challenges?
Mm-hmm. I think most of them I've touched on. So the e-transfer, the funding distribution, that was the biggest one, honestly, that we faced, which was just like a logistical thing that I never would have thought of before running this project. So in terms of overcoming that, it was really just some clever and potentially sketchy, but I don't think sketchy, financial, things that we MacGyvering that we had to do to make sure we got the money out. So just a word of caution to folks, if you are planning to use GoFundMe, I think I mentioned this before, just, you know, have a plan in place for how you want to get the money out. In terms of other obstacles, I don't think there's anything else. You know, the boundaries and the commitment and the effort was, of course, a big thing, but we just chatted about that. So other than that, I don't think there were any big obstacles. It was honestly such a rewarding project for me and really humbling as well to just, I mean, again, I'm an engineer and I became an engineer so that I could make the world a better place. And as an engineer, I love seeing how the designs and the work that I do actually makes it to the real world. And to me, this was something where I co-created something and it had an impact in the real world. It really helped people. So it was just a really fulfilling project. And I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to be a part of it.
And I think all the people who benefited from that fundraising and that distribution also very much appreciated that. So thank you, Jasmine. I guess as we begin to wind things down, I'd love to put the host microphone temporarily in your hand. And I'm curious if you have any particular question, whether it's professional or personal, that you have for me.
Mm-hmm. So one question that I'm curious about, and I would love to get your thoughts on. So you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that you would like to see more engineers and folks with that kind of analytical background in the philanthropy space. I'm curious, like, what would that look like to you? So how do you envision these folks getting involved? Is it through running their own projects? Is it simply through volunteering? And what do you think the impact of having more engineering and STEM folks in this space could be?
Yeah, well, I think, for example, you're perfect evidence of what happens when people who have a STEM background get involved. There's a lot of methodology that's involved in terms of thinking and testing ideas. There's a willingness to move past ideas and not just be focused on them because we want them to work, but being empirical and pushing aside if there's an idea that clearly isn't working and the evidence doesn't suggest that it does. Being very evidence-driven, not that those who have non-STEM backgrounds aren't evidence-driven. And I think just a different style of thinking. And I said this a bit at the top of our conversation, but looking at how not just to fix things or to make things into a quote-unquote ideal state, but how to constantly look at making things better and accepting that there is no perfect state to begin with. I think of friends of mine who have gone on to do 3D printing for prosthetics for individuals around the world, for founding cool content platforms like Future of Good, and just bringing that different style and approach that I think you get from being surrounded by a lot of problem solvers and tinkerers and people willing to work at different things. And I think in terms of the specific involvements, I think whether they're on more of the volunteer side of things in terms of advising organizations of what to try differently and bringing a different perspective in that they're not steeped in this type of work all the time, being leaders of organizations and helping to shape what direction organizations choose to take and perhaps where to invest certain resources or build relationships or build bridges, pardon the pun, or being actual employees of organizations and starting their own to see where there might be gaps in knowledge or there might be gaps in understanding and going out and trying to test and learn to see where those gaps necessarily are and how we can try to fill them and also to build on what others have done before. So I think those would be some of the ways that I would hope that those who have STEM backgrounds or STEAM backgrounds are able to become more embedded and more involved in the sector. And while I think we do an okay job in the sector of doing it, I think there's so much more potential that could be there, and that there's a lot of steps to get people involved that could be happening hopefully earlier, either at that high school or university college level, or somewhere in between, whether it's through professional associations or other partnerships.
I love that. And I love what you mentioned about testing and prototypes and kind of just really getting things out the door. There's so many similarities between how, you know, an engineering project or a technical product is built in terms of going through iterations of the project and not being married to the first version of your product and really being okay with shipping something that isn't 100% perfect to your customers or to your recipients, and knowing that you'll receive feedback from your users and then you can tweak it. There's so many similarities there between that methodology and how some of these projects are run. And this is one of the things that I am kind of passionate about. That's a whole other rabbit hole, but just being able to kind of share common techniques and methodologies and frameworks between sectors, I think it's so cool, and we definitely need more of it.
I couldn't agree with you more, Jasmine. And again, I think there needs to be more tinkers and more people who aren't embarrassed when something doesn't work perfectly. I think there's a lot of pressure that gets put on the social impact world in terms of accountability of dollars and things like that, when in reality, we're the ones who should be able to be the riskiest and the ones who take the most amount of chances, and the ones who try things and launch things without them being perfect. And we just don't get that. And I would hope that by having more individuals with those STEM and STEAM backgrounds, that they would encourage and hopefully reward that type of thinking and approach to things. But we can all hope, and we can all try to do our little parts to get more people with those backgrounds involved in this important work that continues to march forward. So Jasmine, I'd love to turn it over to you. Thank you first off so much for sharing all these amazing tips and feedback and your journey with this project, along with your other teammates. I think there's a ton that our listeners can take away in thinking about how they want to start their own projects, how they want to think about and use opportunities and timing to launch their own projects, and thinking about who they might choose to partner with. Would love to turn it over to you and have you share with our listeners what you have going on and how people can be in touch or involved with what you're working on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again for having me. This has been such a fun conversation. So in terms of the project, so of course I mentioned it was time bound and it is closed, but we do still have our website up. It's onsickdayreliefproject.org, and I'm sure it will be in the show notes where you can just learn about the impact of the project. Of course, nothing's still, applications are closed, but if you just want to check it out and kind of see the impact that is shared there. And in terms of myself, so I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, but I am a newbie entrepreneur just venturing into the world of online business. So if you do happen to be a woman in STEM, or if you're interested in career content and leveling up your career, then I would love for you to be a part of my community. So I am active on primarily Instagram and LinkedIn. So it's Jasmine A. Shaw. Join me, say hi, come check out some of the things that I'm doing there. And I also host not a podcast, I'm not sure what to call it, an interview series, I suppose, on Instagram Live called Tech Talks, where I interview folks in STEM who are doing awesome things and to amplify their stories and accomplishments. So if you want to be a part of the show as a guest, then feel free to reach out to me and I'd love to have you on the show.
We will definitely link all of those in the show notes. And I do hope that a lot of our listeners who maybe are in the nonprofit charitable space, but have maybe some volunteers, or they themselves have some of those STEM backgrounds, do reach out to Jasmine. And I think those would be fantastic conversations. I'm looking forward to bookmarking those. Again, Jasmine, thank you so much, not just for this conversation, but for all that you do and all that you work on. I think you're a fantastic person, and this space is very lucky to have you. So thanks for all that you do. Hey, everyone, it's Christian. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, we would love if you could leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to the show. This helps to make sure that we can help others raise more time, talent, and treasure for the causes they care about. If you haven't already, make sure you hit that subscribe button to never miss when we release an episode. And finally, if you want to get even more content from us, please head over to our website at www.btbs.ca and subscribe to our newsletter. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.